Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.
From Valley Public Radio, serving Central California from Bakersfield to Merced, this is Valley Edition, FM89's weekly news magazine program. I'm Joe Moore. On today's show, we'll look at the political fallout over one of the biggest news stories of 2016 in Fresno, rusty water in Northeast Fresno homes that in some cases and in some homes contains lead. Both Lee Brand and Henry Perea are going back and forth on the matter, exchanging blame and potential solutions. We'll talk about who has the upper hand and what it means for the November election. We'll also talk to the Tulare County woman recently honored by the White House for her part in bringing clean water to Valley residents. But first, we turn our attention to a story we've talked about a few times now on our program, and that's the Erskine Fire. It burned over 50,000 acres around Lake Isabella back in June and destroyed more than 280 homes, displacing thousands of people. And as FM 89's Ezra David Romero reports, those residents are trying to figure out whether rebuilding is actually worth it.
Shelley Bryant has worked in Kern County's oil industry for more than 30 years. She saved and used some of her retirement so she could buy a plot of land and a trailer in the community of South Lake, not far from the shores of Lake Isabella. Her dream of moving to this property full-time is gone.
It was really emotional for me because this was one of the first properties that I had purchased myself, being a single mother. Yeah, it's overwhelming.
South Lake is a really windy area that's surrounded on three sides by steep desert mountains. When the fire reached the tips of these hills, it rushed down and consumed a large portion of this community. Row after row of houses are no longer there. Metal frames, chain-link fences, and American flags are all that stand. Bryant and her father, Bud Ayers, are digging through the ashes to hopefully save their septic tank in order to cut the cost of rebuilding, because her place was underinsured.
From the estimate that I got, it would cost $137,500 to put a new place in here like the one that was here. And the insurance would only pay, their maximum is $92,000.
Bryant isn't sure how she'll make up that difference. In the meantime, she's living at her second home in Bakersfield. Even though her home was demolished, she's considered one of the lucky ones in this community where the average income is less than $20,000 a year. Hundreds of people are still couch surfing or staying at hotels. Deborah Hess with the Kern Valley Healthcare District says finding housing in this mountain community is tough.
What I'm seeing the biggest need right now is we do not have enough rentals for the people that's been displaced. That is our number one problem.
Because there aren't enough homes, these residents were hoping to get temporary housing through FEMA. But FEMA rejected aid, saying damage from the blaze was not of such severity and magnitude as to be beyond the capabilities of state and local government help. This felt like a blow to the community, where around 100 of the destroyed homes were uninsured. Doris Stevens with the American Legion is helping aid the 41 veterans affected by the fire.
The income here is ridiculous. You had to have over 800 uninsured homes burned. This place would be wiped out. We lost nearly an entire community.
But late last week, the California Office of Emergency Services decided to offer 71 manufactured housing units to fire victims in this mountain community. The Kern County Board of Supervisors will most likely approve the aid at their meeting this week. The county is taking applications from fire victims, but before the homes are installed in a few weeks, crews will clear out debris and contaminated soil, a task funded by the state at around $50,000 per home. Down the mountain in Bakersfield, a group of techies is trying to figure out other solutions for this community.
This is the first wildfire hackathon that I've ever heard of. So everyone give yourself a round of applause.
Alyssa Hairley with the Kern Innovation and Technology Community organized a wildfire-themed hackathon this past weekend.
We want to create technology that actually helps people, not just another phone app or a game.
Teams gathered together to create computer programs and apps over a three-day period. One attendee pitched an idea to use drones to collect real-time data and to offer assistance to fire victims. Scott Barton, one of the founders of a tech collaborative in Bakersfield called Mesh Cowork, pitched an app called Beacon that allows a user to create a pin of their location in the affected area.
You list all the different items that you need in a fire or flood or earthquake, and we will do location-based calls, emails to different resources automatically for you.
It's ideas like this that hopefully in the future will help aid authorities during a blaze and diffuse confusion in the aftermath that follows catastrophes like the Erskine fire. With Valley Public Radio, I'm Ezra David Romero.
Voters in Tulare this month are being asked to weigh in on a big issue, whether or not to support a new $55 million bond measure for hospital construction at the Tulare Regional Medical Center. You may recall the hospital last issued an $85 million bond back in 2005 to fund a new tower for the hospital district, but the project went out of control and construction stopped as the money ran out. Will voters choose to support the new project now in 2016, especially after the hospital received a one-star rating in a new report from the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services? Joining us now on the phone, we have Visalia Times Delta reporter Jim Houck, who's part of a major team coverage the Times Delta did on the future of Tulare Regional. Jim, welcome.
Thank you.
From the 30,000-foot perspective here, some of our listeners know a lot about the hospital problems, but a lot of them don't. What exactly happened to get Tulare Regional in such a difficult situation? They've been working to get out of it for a few years now, but how did things go wrong in a snapshot view?
Well, there's a lot to it, but and it goes back a good number of years. I think it depends on your perspective on whether you were involved in the situation or whether you're a voter. I think a lot of residents felt that $85 million, which was the first bond issue, was gonna do it. They were gonna get a tower for that. Well,
and that's what they were told.
yeah, sort of. That's part of the problem. The hospital very quietly say that the project would. I think the first estimate was $100 million, but they never made a big deal out of that. Nonetheless, the people involved knew that $85 million wouldn't do it. They picked $85 million because they figured that's what they could get passed. They could get the votes they needed for $85 million and not much more. That's part of the problem. The other part of the problem was that there were dramatic cost overruns. The original plans were faulty, and so there were millions of dollars of change orders that went through. There was also a political problems within the board of the district, and on top of that, there was a move that sort of started in about 2010 to. What they called an affiliation, which meant a linkage with another management organization or hospital or something like that. They really weren't sure. And so what happened, I think in 2014, was that the board decided, well, we'll turn this management over to a company called HCCA, and The HCCA will appoint the CEO and they'll run the place. Well, that created a lot of questions among some people. The hospital, the supporters of the bond said, well, what happened here is that all of a sudden the hospital started making money and it was better run. And yeah, it's true, it did start making money. But the downside was that the hospital was one way or another going to be turned over to a private company, and the public control was going to be gone. And so that was part of the issue.
So now your series in the Times Delta looks at a lot of different issues here, including the regional competition that the Tulare Hospital faces just down the road in Visalia from Kauai Delta, also a public hospital. It's a hospital district as well. This is something that's not entirely unique to Tulare County, but it's certainly a big part of the local healthcare landscape. Has there been an increased number of people from Tulare going to Visalia for healthcare because of these problems?
I don't really know that. I think that's true, but basically, I kind of came up with those numbers almost accidentally, and I was very surprised basically what the story said was that 10 years before, about two-thirds to three-quarters of people who lived in the Tulare district were using the Tulare Hospital. That changed to 50%, and the other half were going to Kauai Delta. I was never really able to pin down exactly why. I think my hunch is that there were several. There are several factors here, but you know it was. I think, and it's, you know, it, like I say, it's kind of hard to say.
As we're talking about the future of Tulare Regional Medical Center, hospitals are certainly changing all around us in every community in California as the healthcare industry continues to evolve, to grow. There's a lot of consolidation and things like that. In smaller communities in the Valley, we've seen many small hospitals go away. You asked the question in one of the stories in your series, do the public in Tulare want a hospital? Is that something, can we make it as simple as that when it comes to this vote that's taking place by mail this month? Is this essentially a referendum on the future of Tulare Regional?
Well, it's a referendum on the future. It's the referendum on Tulare Regional. There's no question about it. The supporters of the bond issue are essentially claiming that if you don't pass this bond, the hospital is going to close. Well, that's not really the case. And there's a lot of argument about that. My reporting indicates that it could close, but it would close because they failed to meet new seismic standards that they're supposed to meet in 2030, I think. I don't know enough about, Tulare is a, I don't live in Tulare, although my family is from Tulare. Tulare is a very proud place. People in Tulare don't really care much for Visalia, if they don't like to be compared to Visalia, and I think that's part of the issue. But is it a referendum on whether they want a hospital? I would assume that most people in Tulare want a hospital there. I've never heard anybody say, no, I don't want a hospital here. So I think the issue is a little more subtle than that.
Jim Houck from the Visalia Times Delta with us today. Now, just a few months ago, there was another hospital bond measure on the ballot in Tulare County, specifically this time in Visalia for the Kauai Delta Hospital District, also that was going to fund hospital construction to meet these new seismic standards to replace an old part of the hospital that was built back in, I guess, the 50s or 60s. That was rejected by voters. Is that maybe a sense of the temperature of the public in Tulare County right now towards spending like this? Can we read anything into that when it comes to this new bond measure?
Well, I think that there were some interesting issues in the Kauai Delta bond issue, bond election. One was its size. They were asking for a heck of a lot of money, and they were asking for it all at once. That's number one. Number two, there was a fairly widespread belief that people in within the Kauai Delta district were paying for a hospital that everybody was using, who weren't going to be paying off this bond, and that really bothered a lot of people. And the problem was that there wasn't really much that could be done about that. You can't tell people they can't come to your hospital because they don't live in your district. If they show up and they need to be hospitalized or they need to be cared for, they get cared for. That's the law, and that's the way it's going to be. I don't know how Kauai Delta or Tulare, for that matter, gets around this. They can't do it. The other issue was an interesting issue that I think was one of the primary opponents of the bond issue was the man who is the CEO of the Tulare Hospital. And he put a lot of money in, sent out a lot of flyers and opposing the Kauai Delta bond issue. I'm not quite sure why he did this, but he did, and I think it had an effect.
Jim Houck with us today talking about this election. So just before we go, how is the election working? This is not on the November ballot. It's a mail-in ballot that's out right now?
Yeah, this is a product of a change in the state law. I'm not exactly sure when it changed, but under certain circumstances, agencies like the Tulare Hospital District can say that we'd prefer to have a mail election. And what happens is that ballots are mailed to all the registered voters in the district, and the registered voters then vote and send the ballots back. It's like it's much cheaper, and I think there are some problems with it, but that's what they chose to do. What you have is you have a 30-day period to send your ballot back. I think the ballots were supposed to be mailed on the 1st of August, and they have to be mailed back by the 30th, I think.
Is it significant that they chose to do it in this fashion and not wait the few extra months to put it on the November ballot, especially considering we're expecting a rather high turnout in a presidential general election versus a special election in the middle of the summer?
So you'd have to ask them, but I assume that was part of the calculation. One of the things that's one of the things that you see a lot of is that it's changing. But, for example, the city of Visalia, for years, elected its city council in odd-numbered years. The reason, quite frankly, the city manager admitted to us in a meeting, was that the people they wanted to vote, who were going to be supporting them, would vote regardless of when the election was, and the people who might not be supporting them would be voting only in, say, the presidential year or an even numbered year. They were forced to change this, but nonetheless, that was clearly a factor. And I think I think you can assume that that was the same factor in Tulare. The same thing was true in Visalia. I mean, the Cuya Delta election was. I wasn't here at the time. I don't think it was it was a mail.
It was.
It was in March or April, or I guess, or May, something like that. Same idea. I mean, they could have waited a month, but they chose not to because they figured that their people would the people who were their natural supporters would come out, would vote anyway.
And it's probably not the last time we will see a special election decide a major issue here in the Valley. And this one is coming up in Tulare. Again, voters being asked to support a new $55 million bond measure for hospital construction at the Tulare Regional Medical Center. Jim Houck with the Visalia Times Delta joining us today. They wrote a big series about the future of the Tulare Hospital in the paper. You can read it online at the Times Delta as well. Jim, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you very much for calling.
When we talk about water in the San Joaquin Valley, it's often to highlight water problems like dry wells, contaminated drinking water, or more recently, toxic algae in lakes and reservoirs. But the news isn't all bad. Local advocate Susanna DeAnda recently won an award from the White House for her work bringing clean water to Valley communities. FM 89's Carrie Klein sat down with DeAnda at her office in Visalia and brings us this interview.
So, Susanna, you're the co-founder and the co-director of the Community Water Center. What does the Community Water Center do?
Community Water Center believes that clean water is a basic human right and it should not be a privilege. So on a daily basis, we work to ensure that we bring about equity to all Californians. Our mission is to be a catalyst for community water-driven solutions through organizing, advocacy, and education.
What are some of the biggest issues that keep cropping up that you find yourself dealing with here at the center?
You know, unfortunately, every year over 1 million Californians are exposed to illegal and unsafe levels of contaminants found in their drinking water. In addition to that, we're paying for some really expensive water rates for toxic water. What that means is that our hardworking familias are having to pay twice for water for a toxic water bill, and in addition to that, having to find additional drinking water just to have safe drinking water in the home. It is not okay to have nitrates in your water. It is not safe to have arsenic or 1-2-3 TCP or anything of that nature in your drinking water. It's just not safe, and it shouldn't be there.
And so we're speaking today because the White House recently named you a champion of change for climate equity. So first off, what is climate equity and how does that specifically fit into the work you do here at the Community Water Center?
You know, climate equity means that we're bringing about solutions to people impacted by climate change in a way that's practical and real. We have to really sit around the table and figure out solutions that are going to be applicable to the unique conditions of our communities. That's equity. And having the honor of receiving this award really has helped us continue to amplify the work that we have at a different scale. It's important that nationwide we connect with other organizations and advocates and residents to understand what is your drinking water quality. And I think it's important to recognize that climate change is very real and it's happening right now with a lot of our community partners. You know, a lot of families right now in California don't have running water. And I think it's important to understand that water quality and water supply go hand in hand. And it's not to say that climate change has just happened right now because we have a lot of wells that have gone dry. No, a lot of residents, a lot of schools don't have safe drinking water. And that's a huge direct correlation with climate change. Things are changing. And again, it is our poorest families who are exposed to this injustice who need to be at the forefront for resources and leverage attention so that we don't have to continue to condemn future families to live with this condition.
Well, going back to you individually, I mean, this is not the first time that you have been singled out for your accomplishments, for your drive for social justice. You won a big award in 2009, the Petro Award, which is for unsung heroes who fight for social change. Newsweek in 2012 named you one of its 150 fearless women in the world. You've been featured in documentaries and books. Is this award just kind of the same old for you?
No, every award is a blessing, and I'm really grateful for the recognitions that we're getting. I'm very privileged to do what I do. It's a true honor to work towards sustainable solutions to bring about change for our communities that don't have safe drinking water. Every award and every recognition, every platform that we have, we're going to continue to leverage it to bring attention and solutions to the area. It is not okay that in 2016, we continue to condemn future generations and current generations to live with this condition of fearing that they're going to become sick if they drink tap water. That is just not okay. And no one needs to live like that.
So what drives this for you? How did you get involved in this community advocacy, in this environmental advocacy to begin with?
When I originally met Laurel Firestone, I was an organizer with Center on Race, Poverty, and the Environment, and I learned a lot from her in terms of all the reports that she was looking at in terms of water quality problems across the Central Valley. And when we just started door knocking and asking residents, do you know your water quality? Do you drink it? What do you do about that? It was very clear to me that people are so ready for change and opportunities to bring about solutions in their community. And when you see that magic that the most impacted residents understand that it's wrong and they only need a little bit of help to figure out solutions and opportunities, they're more than ready to do that. And now you can't go back. We're here to the end. We're here to ensure that every Californian every day has access to safe, clean, and running water.
And so a lot of the communities that you work with, they have water contaminated with arsenic, with nitrates. They don't have access, perhaps, to other sources of clean water. So it sounds simple enough. They don't have clean water. Let's give it to them. But what are the challenges of actually doing that?
You know, unfortunately, this is not an issue of just a classic engineering problem. It's an issue of access to adequate resources and resources that are going to be applicable and useful for communities. Many times, a lot of the public water systems are functioning with old and dilapidated infrastructure, wells that are contaminated. So they themselves also need major resources to ensure that they can provide safe drinking water to their constituents.
Can you give some specific examples of some of the big campaigns on your plate?
Yes. So we have a couple of campaigns. One, we want to make sure that we continue to really propel groundwater ordinances and reform. You know, it's really important to understand that we have two sources of water. We have surface water and groundwater. And unfortunately, our groundwater has been overpumped and overused. And one of our campaigns is to ensure that we bring about sustainability to our groundwater sources and really focus here in Tulare County to ensure that we provide an emergency groundwater ordinance that ultimately limits the amount of water that's being used and really think about using it responsibly and to ensure that, you know, humans are not negatively impacted when we're doing major overdraft. In addition to that, we have a huge campaign to really set forward an MCL on 123 DCP.
And what's an MCL?
Maximum contaminant level. This is a serious contaminant found in our drinking water. We want to make sure that we have an MCL so we can start to regulate that contaminant and to inform the consumer. In addition to East Porterville, East Porterville has been highlighted a number of times around the drought. And, you know, it's important that we realize that we have major negative impacts that are being felt by many residents, but it's also important that we highlight the solutions, right? So even though currently in East Porterville, we have many families without running water, I'm happy to say that this month we're going to start connecting the first ones, right? And I think, once again, you know, it's important to work short-term and long-term, but again, we have to have that vision. And I really believe that through organizing and advocacy, we bring about change.
Great. Okay. Well, Susana De Anda, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This is Valley Edition. It's the middle of summer. It's often the time that political races in an election year take a bit of a lull, but the Fresno mayor's race is starting to heat up with one issue and one issue alone, and that's water. But it's not the lack of water. In this case, it's water quality in some homes in northeast Fresno. This issue of rusty pipes, in some cases generating water that has elevated levels of lead in some homes in northeast Fresno. John Ellis has been covering the political aspect of this story with the Fresno Bee. He joins us now here at Valley Public Radio. John, welcome.
Thanks, Joe.
Is this something you would ever thought that there would be one sole issue and that's pretty much the only thing candidates are talking about right now? And it's really one that only affects a few dozen families in northeast Fresno right now that we know of.
Right. Well, no, especially considering the myriad issues that were discussed in the primary when there's five people running and now it's down to two, Henry Perea and Lee Brand. And you had almost nothing. Yeah, I mean, nothing about water was even, hint, even though this issue had really started heating up in January, it was not an issue at all in the primary election. And I think I'm really not quite sure. It's just I think that there was some residents that spoke up in June, and then Perea has latched onto that and he will not let it go. Of course, we're in the doldrums of summer. There's people on vacation. People are barely paying attention. I would call this a very localized issue, regional. And that, by region, I mean like District 6 of the city of Fresno, which happens to be Lee Brand's district.
Exactly. And so that poses a political problem for Lee, who says that the city is doing what it can. He's offering to do various things, including sponsoring legislation to ban the installation of new galvanized pipes.
And when Henry says, hey, this builders haven't been doing it, builders self eliminated that in 2004.
Yeah, so that's happening. And also, Lee is sponsoring some legislation to devote some city money to fund repairs for faucets and, in some cases, maybe even pipes for residents there.
Right, so Lee says, I'm offering solutions. Henry, you're offering sound bites. I mean, they've really entrenched their talking points are very entrenched
right
now.
So what exactly is Henry's position on this issue? He's a current Fresno County supervisor. He doesn't represent that part of the county or Lee's district, but where does he fall in? Because he is taking a lot of shots at Lee. Where does he fall on this issue?
Well, he's claiming that this is a question of leadership, and this shows that Lee lacks the leadership to be mayor of the city of Fresno, because this issue has been around since 2004 when Jerry Duncan was the city council member there. But Lee Brand owns some properties. He manages properties. And one of his tenants contacted him about discolored water at that particular point in time, way back in 04 or 05. Lee contacted the city. The tenant was told to just run which is what's still being told to some people, just run the water until you see it clear. And it's going to be fine. It's just some issues with the pipe. And this is all goes back to the moving from well water to surface water when the Northeast Surface Water Treatment Plant came online. Surface water is a different chemical makeup than well water, and so that's why I think when you trace the problem here, that's what it is. It comes down to. And so this tenant was told to run the water, and then Lee says, "Hey, I was never heard. I never heard back from her, so problem solved." And then Henry says, well, you hired the same council member as Jerry Duncan, council assistant, kept her on as your council assistant. This she knew about the problem. There's been inaction. And even in January, and so he says, and then Lee says, well, in January is when he really knew there's a problem, because he got an email that had an attachment. And he said, now we got the era of social media. There was an attachment. It was this one person with 16. She had attached this chain of comments through social media. And Lee says, whoa, that's when I saw that it was a real problem. That's when I went to the city. That's when this whole thing started moving, and we started really trying to look. And we've been looking behind the scenes for a solution. And then, so Henry says, it's kind of a long, drawn-out thing, but Henry says in June, you guys really only started paying attention when Henry held a news conference to call attention to the issue. And Lee says, no, we have been working behind the scenes. You just are a county supervisor, and you don't know what's going on behind the scenes because you're over in the county. We're in the city working hard for a solution, and then you call a news conference. You put bottled water on doorsteps. It's a gimmick. You are just trying to make a political issue out of something that I am trying to work hard to find substantive solutions to. So that's kind of their entrenched political positions now. And so Henry's not letting it go. And, it's a scary issue. There's been lead found in a few houses, and in those houses, I think even fewer still have been at levels that are, maybe at a concerning level. And the city is saying that they are working to find a correct balance, chemical balance in the water. In the meantime, There may have to be some replacements because they say they've tested the at the plant. They've tested all the pipes leading up to the houses. It's inside the houses. It's the piping that was used in the houses primarily, they think, in homes built between 1990 and 2000, sometime in that time frame. So they're saying that they're working on a solution. A solution is at hand. And Henry's saying, you have waited until I called attention to it, Lee Brand, to do anything about it. Therefore, that just shows your leadership plan. I'm trying to find solutions. You are sitting on your hands and your constituents are saying there's a problem.
So now Lee is also trying to turn it back on Henry, though, with a problem in his own district with a school.
Yes, the Orange Center school, which is it's like an elementary school district out there, a little rural school, not in the city of Fresno, but now is being hooked up to Fresno City Water because they had problems with their drinking water. And now, you know, it's a solutions is being done right now. I mean, the city's running pipes out there. They're going to join into the city water system. Lee says that went on for years and you did nothing. And then I think Henry has said, well, that's, you know, it's a school district issue. But of course, at the same time, Henry's been saying that, I mean, he's been rattling cages about Clovis Unified, which Northeast Fresno is part of the Clovis Unified School District, not part of the Fresno Unified School District. So Henry's been saying, you know, Henry's reaching out to Clovis Unified to make sure the parents are notified and that the schools are tested. Lee's like, we're already, and city officials like, we're already there. We're way ahead of you. And that's been the whole debate. We're way ahead of you. You're trying to make political issue out of it. We're already taking these steps. And then Lee's saying, Henry, you got problems in your own backyard that you haven't taken care of. So it's just this, it's, you know, all of a sudden, I mean, this is it. This is the only issue that you've heard about. If anybody's been paying attention and they haven't been on summer vacation or kind of distracted by barbecue in the backyard, if they've actually been paying attention, this has been the only issue in the Fresno mayor's race for 2 months now.
So what should voters be paying attention to, or what should the candidates be paying attention to? Other things looming at City Hall, you have this whole issue about police protests and those sorts of things. Do you think that will emerge as an issue, or is that too politically sensitive for the candidates to really get into
Well, both candidates love Jerry Dyer, the Fresno police chief. So whether they do or not deep in their heart, I don't know. But certainly publicly, they're not stupid. Dyer, whatever you want to say about Dyer, he's immensely popular. And that's why I think when he says that I would like to stay until this date, which is like three years or so into the next term of the mayor, they both are like, yes. Now, once you elect them, if they go behind the scenes and say, Chief, you know, you're a disaster. I don't know. But publicly, they are supportive of him. They're supportive of him staying until he wants to leave. That's why when he says, I'm going to do this, you know, with handling the Black Lives Matter protests or, you know, the way that the Dylan Noble shooting has unfolded, you know, Chief Dyer has, you know, after, you know, some video emerged. So Chief Dyer chose to show the body cam videos. And I think, you know, he's been defending his officers, but he's also said, you know, that the final two shots concerned him too. So he's been talking about this, but the candidates haven't, because it's a touchy, as you say, it is a very touchy issue. And you have a whole segment of the population, a lot of them in the southeast and southwest part of the cities. You have Faith and Community, which has been very vocal in saying that there is not the trust level is not there, but and they're trying to get those people engaged in the political process. They're actually going out walking precincts, trying to get low propensity voters to go to the polls. But right now, Brand and Perea are speaking to the high propensity voters. And those voters are, I think, very supportive of law enforcement, the efforts of law enforcement Chief Dyer. So that's why you don't hear them talking about this. That was an issue in the primary. You know, crime is an issue, vagrancy, homelessness, the baseball stadium, downtown revitalization, the city's general plan, bus rapid transit. You know, we could keep going, but, you know, I don't know what's going to happen. It's going to be interesting to see what's going to happen in September when this race really heats up, September, October, when it is crunch time. I mean, are we still only going to be talking about water? Are these guys going to, I mean, I think part of us in the media, it's our role to try to broaden the spectrum of discussion beyond just water.
And with that in mind, you mentioned a downtown revitalization and the general plan, things that Mayor Swearengen could hardly go 5 minutes without talking if you sat down with her. Right. Henry, the other day on Facebook, on a post about the new downtown specific plan, which is now out in draft form, someone was commenting on various intricacies of the plan, saying it allows this, it doesn't allow this. He says, oh, if I'm elected, we're going to go in there and we're going to change the plan because we don't like the way that this current plan, the Swearengen administration has drafted, yeah, is going to work. Sounds like that might heat up then as a campaign issue. Is Lee going to fall in line with supporting Ashley's vision, or go in that direction?
I don't know what else Lee can do. Otherwise, he's going to look like a political hypocrite, because Lee has been on board with what Ashley's wanted to do as mayor. I mean, he's been one of her staunchest allies on city council. You know, I don't think those guys are best beer drinking buddies. You know, they're not enemies. They're not, but I don't know that they're not lockstep in alliance, but Lee has been very helpful to Swearengen on the council. And he has been supportive of her general plan, which focuses on infill, tries to hold the line on city growth, on city expansion at the fringes. Henry is, he doesn't take a rocket scientist to look at this. Henry is supported by almost every home builder developer in the city. Lee is only supported by maybe a couple.
Is that a huge political flip? Just something significant to note here. Henry, this is a nonpartisan race, but Henry is very much a Democrat, and Democrats locally have traditionally been more on the quote-unquote smart growth path, and Republicans have typically,
it is interesting,
been the, yeah, ones who are supporting the,
but if you look at the new general plan side, which Lee has supported, the home builders don't really like. And I think in particular, Dari Sassimi at Granville has been especially hostile towards Swearengen. That has been like a barely contained, I mean, there's, I think, an intense amount of dislike on both sides there, probably, certainly on Darius' side. So he's frustrated with Lee. He doesn't like, you know, they had the general plan, the development code went with it. First time it's really been wholesale updated since like 1964 or something like that. Darius was so frustrated with that process. He says, you know, that Lee had said he was going to do something on the vote some way. And then he said, he claims that Ashley pulled him out, and 5 minutes later he came back and switched it. You know, I wasn't there in particular to know what was going on. But I think that Darius sees Lee as being Ashley's successor. So he is, you know, and if you look at the donations, I mean, Darius has been really supportive of Henry, but he also gave money to Spies in the primary. The only major candidate who got no money was Brand. So I think that sends a message, certainly, from Darius. And then I think the Wilsons, I mean, there's been some, the Madera County, you know, Fresno sued Madera County over the building up at Rio Mesa and the area north of the river by Children's Hospital. You know, Brand was part of that. So, you know, some of these home builders are mad at the status quo. What's at City Hall now? Henry is not at City Hall. Henry is a phenomenal politician. I give him he can go up there and he can talk. And I'm sure, and Ed Cashin has been the commercial developer, developed River Park, has long been supportive of Henry way back. You know, Ed might have talked, I mean, these guys may have talked. I don't know. They might have said, hey, Henry's our guy. He's the better guy for the future. Not Lee. I think, you know,
we'll see what happens.
Yeah, Lee certainly, though, I think Lee is very much would keep things as they are with the general plan. Henry, I think he would push for changes. I think you'd see, which would be interesting, considering somebody like Esmeralda Soria on the council has been probably one of his biggest allies. And she represents, you know, some of the poorer parts of the city. A lot of the advocates down there, they like this infill push, and they want to see that.
Maybe that will be the next issue to emerge in the campaign after folks move on from the water issue, although that
not
will
as sexy,
continue to fall.
Not as sexy and not as immediate as water coming out of your tap, but certainly for long-range vision and when you think about what you want Fresno to be, it's a huge issue.
John Ellis, political reporter with the Fresno Bee. You can read his work online and in the traditional Bee at newsstands and at your home delivery as well. John, thanks so much for joining us.
Anytime, Joe.
This is Valley Edition. Northern California's only native turtle is in danger. In an effort to keep the northern western pond turtle from dying off, the Fresno Chaffee Zoo is involved in a repopulation program with the Association of Zoos and Aquariums Save Animals from Extinction program. To learn more about these reptiles, FM89's reporter Ezra David Romero visited the zoo and chatted with reptile keeper Dustin Piontek.
Dustin, thanks for joining me. Tell me about these western pond turtles.
As of right now, we have about 20 to 30 on site right now, and they are a species of special concern. So that's an animal that we are monitoring out in the wild in California. So in Oregon and Washington, they are a protected species and endangered species, but California, they are a species of special concern. So if that were to raise up, then that would change kind of what our procedures are for what we're going to do as far as relocation, that kind of stuff. But as of right now, we have 20 to 30, and they are a smaller pond turtle, so California's only native pond turtle. We say native because there are a lot of non-native species that have been reintroduced into this area, or introduced, not reintroduced. So the animals such as the red-eared slider, which is a common pet turtle, and then even bullfrogs. American bullfrogs can get pretty big, and they have a special taste for these little guys, too. So that kind of, those kind of really affect these guys in a negative way. Red-eared sliders get a lot bigger than them, and they tend to be more aggressive, too. So they kind of fit into that niche that they're trying to take over. So
if I were out in the wild on a hike or something, where would I find these guys?
Any kind of wetland, water of any kind. So rivers, streams, ponds, bogs, any kind of body of water that has kind of logs laying in above the surface where they can bask is really good habitat for them. And sometimes they'll travel long distances to get to the perfect area for them. Because a lot of these obviously gets really hot here in California, so some of the wetlands will dry up and they'll have to either bury themselves in the mud or move to another body of water.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about these turtles. What do they look like if for someone who's never seen one?
Sure, they can be kind of pretty in a way if you look close enough. They have kind of speckled yellow and olive colors to them. The males will often, especially you'll see them when they're adults, will have a lighter colored throat. And that you can't really see until they're 10 plus years old. But they have nice markings on their neck with different spots. Obviously, you'll be able to tell them from any other pond turtle, mostly because they're smaller and the other pond turtles are going to have that red marking on the side of their head. Those are the real common ones, the red-eared sliders. So there's also soft-shell turtles and snapping turtles that have been introduced to the state. But as far as what animals you'll see basking, it's going to be these kind of turtles.
So what are the problems that these turtles are facing?
Well, for a long time, they were actually eaten. Apparently, Americans had a taste for turtle food, for turtles. And so for at least 100 years ago or more, a lot of them would be removed from the wild because of that. That has changed, so most of it now is habitat, so draining of wetlands for agriculture. And also, like I said, the introduction of invasive species where you know they compete for them for resources. So those are the main ones.
So invasive species and things like that are eating them?
Yeah, they're eating them and then taking their place and eating their food as well, too. Those non-native turtles are eating a lot of the frog. I mean, they'll eat tadpoles, insects, frogs, and roots of different aquatic plants. So if there's a bigger turtle around, it's going to get more of that food.
So they're being pushed out.
Yeah, exactly.
Essentially.
Yeah.
So their problem is being eaten all around the soil.
Yeah, they're kind of being attacked by a lot of different sources, and a lot of people think that they need our help if they see them on the roads, too. Like I said, they do travel from long distances, and so oftentimes roads will be intersecting all their areas. So people will stop and then get out of their car and want to move them or touch them with the good intentions or even take them into a wildlife rehabilitation. But the best thing that you can do really is just to leave them alone. You know, you can take them off the road in the direction that they were headed, but oftentimes any kind of disturbance will cause them to abandon, maybe if they're laying eggs nearby, or if they're looking for a suitable habitat, it could just kind of stress them and kind of disorient them. So just leave them alone.
Are western pond turtles native to this area?
Yeah, yep. They're all over the west coast, all the way up to Canada, actually. And then, definitely in the valley you can find them. They are a native pond turtle and a native species overall. So the zoo wants to sometimes invest, you know, in local animals. And so there's a lot of animals that we're looking to get involved with more. And this is one of them for sure.
Yeah, it's part of this larger repopulation plan.
Yeah, yeah. And trying to follow their genetics and have really strong offspring. You know, there are other zoos as well, such as the Oregon Zoo, that are releasing them into the wild as well. So
have any of these been relocated?
Not right now. No. No, these were all hatched out on site. So right now we're just letting them grow up, make sure they're nice and healthy. You can't really relocate them at this time because they're too small. Those bullfrogs will get them. Usually you have to wait at least 4 to 5, possibly more years. They kind of grow slowly.
So a bullfrog will eat these guys?
Yep, absolutely.
Mm-hmm. Wow, it looks like...
They're pretty big, but yeah, bullfrogs get pretty big, and they have a huge mouth, and they'll kind of shove in anything they can fit in. So they've been been seen eating birds and things like that, too, wow. Which is kind of strange. They're strange. Voracious predators, for sure.
So if I'm a kid and I hear this interview, will my parents be able to take me to see these turtles?
At this moment, we don't have them on exhibit, but who knows what the future will hold for these little guys. There is a possibility of having a pond in the future where people can come and see this awesome tortoises, or turtles.
Why are turtles important to this greater ecosystem here in California?
Well, they play an important role. Their eggs will be eaten by a lot of mammals. They actually eat a lot of pests and will eat mosquito larvae when they're really tiny. And who likes mosquitoes? And leeches and small worms and tadpoles and things like that. So they help control other populations. And they're also an important food source, like I said. And people typically just like to enjoy and see turtles basking on logs. It's kind of a cool thing to see. Just their behavior, so as an educational experience too.
Do you have any idea how many of these guys are left in the wild?
No idea.
You just know that they're on this endanger.
Yeah, all the information leads to the fact that their numbers are decreasing in California. And so more studies need to happen to kind of get a better grasp about what exactly is happening to their numbers. But
So tell me about the turtles you have here. I understand there are 17 adults.
20 to 30. We have quite a few. Yeah.
I understand there's some mystery around these turtles and their habits and things like that.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. They are kind of elusive, and there's still being research done on them as far as what they're doing exactly during the winter when it gets too cold. They have the ability to get to bury themselves in mud and actually go through a whole season kind of almost falling asleep, but it's not like a true hibernation because if it warms up, they could wake up. Also, when they do lay their eggs, the eggs will go through a period where they will not hatch. They'll just stay in the egg for better conditions. So if it rains more and loosens up the dirt, those eggs have a mechanism, and not a whole lot is known about exactly how that happens. So that's kind of a cool thing. But
so you might see that here.
Yeah, exactly. Incubating them. Obviously, we make the conditions right for them. We want them all to succeed, so they hatch pretty quickly. But in the wild, when times are really tough, they can actually go a long time without hatching.
Sounds like these turtles' greatest foes were always humans in some sense.
Well, that's a major concern right now, is the release again of those pet turtles, and then people trying to bother them in their environment. Yeah, I guess I would agree with that. People are the major negative effects on these guys.
Sure. Can I hold one of these guys?
Yeah. Let's take this cute little guy here.
Oh my gosh, it's so cute.
So he's probably only 2 or 3 years old at this point.
Oh, he's 2 or 3 years old, yeah. And he's only like 2 or 3 inches?
Yeah, 1.5 maybe. Yeah, and they grow really slowly, like I said, so we give them a lot of food here, a lot of variety. We have an insect day, we have a fish day, and then we have like a turtle chow that they make, actually. So they get a wide variety, and that's to encourage their growth. And they do have a really long tail, too. You'll see that. It's compared to the rest of them. A lot of the other pond turtles will have much shorter tails.
How big will this turtle get?
They're not a very big turtle, about 5 to 7 inches, so not very big at all. And the males will be a little bit, or easier to tell the difference with that yellow neck, too.
We've been talking with Dustin Piontek. He's a reptile keeper at the Fresno Chaffee Zoo.
And that's all for today's Valley Edition. Thanks to Ezra David Romero for that interview with the Fresno Chaffee Zoo Turtle Program. And we thank the rest of our reporters as well, Valley Public Radio's Jeffrey Hess and Carrie Klein, for their contributions to our show. As always, we'd like to know what you think. You can send us your comments and suggestions. Our email address is talk@kvpr.org. On Twitter, we are @KVPR and @Valley Edition. So follow us, tweet us, and all those things. Also on Facebook, the search Valley Public Radio online, and become our friend. For Valley Edition, audio engineer Marv Allen and production and operations manager Don Weaver, I'm Joe Moore. This is Valley Edition on Valley Public Radio. Hope you join us again next week.
Support for Valley Edition comes from the James Irvine Foundation, the California Endowment. Health happens when California values schools more than prisons. Learn more at calendow.org. And by the California Healthcare Foundation, dedicated to a healthcare system that works for all Californians. On the web at chcf.org.